This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Julian Temple was getting started as a filmmaker at about the same time the British punk band The Sex Pistols started playing music. He's since made two documentaries about the group, the 1978 film The Great Rock and Roll Swindle and last year's The Filth and the Fury, which recently came out on video. Temple also directed the movie musical Absolute Beginner, starring David Bowie, and has directed rock videos by Bowie, Neil Young, Tom Petty, and the Rolling Stones. But his new movie isn't about rock stars. It's about two late 18th century British poets, Samuel Coleridge and William Wordsworth. The film describes the idealism that brought them together and the jealousies and opium addiction that tore them apart. In this scene, Coleridge and Wordsworth have started a small utopian community built around nature and poetry. They're having dinner with Wordsworth's sister, Coleridge's wife, and a friend who has just been released from prison. Wordsworth's sister speaks first.
William and Sam are working on a book together.
How do you write one line and he the next, or what?
We've scarce begun to write yet.
We're still gathering material.
The poetry will be simple. It should appear almost not written at all, but discovered.
Like Davy's gases.
And when we publish, it should be anonymously.
What?
I wasn't aware.
I've only just thought of it. It should walk away from the poet, out into the world, an orphan, adopted by every heart that hears it.
But surely Sam is famous. His name would bring in readers.
No, this is brilliant. Anonymous. Like Homer. Like the hills and clouds themselves.
Julian Temple, welcome to Fresh Air. Your new movie is about two poets who lived in the late 18th, early 19th centuries. You're more used to making films about punk rock and videos by rock stars than movies about 18th century poets. Do you see any connections between Wordsworth and Coleridge and the rock and punk musicians that you've documented over the years?
Well, I think you've got to be very wary of too facile a comparison with totally different people in totally different eras and situations. But I did feel very strongly that I wanted to make a film that wasn't perhaps a conventional period movie, but a movie propelled by the idea of how relevant and resonant these two lives and the work of these two men were to our own time. I think they lived in a very similar period to us in strange way, that they were on the brink of the Industrial Age, the Industrial Revolution. Obviously, Coleridge and Wordsworth stand at the beginning, in a sense, of a long tradition of celebrity. They did shock the world, the reading world of their time, profoundly with their first collaborative book, The Lyrical Ballads, by using language that was no longer of the court or the king, but took its inspiration from the everyday words and phrases that they'd hear in the streets, in the taverns, in the fields. They democratized poetry in a very shocking way at their time. And as a result, became hugely famous figures. They share that aspect of shock and celebrity that, you know, perhaps is associated with certain modern, more modern rock stars.
Your documentary about the Sex Pistols, The Filth and the Fury, is out on video now. I want to ask you a little bit about that. It's your second film about this British punk band. The first was from the point of view of their manager, Malcolm McLaren, and that was called The Great Rock and Roll Swindle. The second film, The Filth and the Fury, is more interviews with the band, more from the band's point of view. Let's start with The Great Rock and Roll Swindle. Before that film, which was made in 1978, before that film was made, Malcolm McLaren wanted to make a film, I think, featuring the band that was supposed to be directed by Russ Meyer. And Russ Meyer is most famous for Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill, and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. He's also famous for his obsession with very big-breasted women. What was that film directed by Russ Meyer supposed to be?
It was a very bizarre film, and actually the plot gets even stranger when you realize Roger Ebert wrote the script, actually.
Right, the script for Beyond the...
Who Killed Bambi.
Oh, no. Yeah. I didn't know that. Because he also wrote the script for Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Yeah. So perhaps you should talk to him. But it was a kind of Robin Hood story of a big kind of Rod Stewart 70s rock star figure who is kills of deer in the forest, and I have only vague recollections of it, but he kills this Bambi figure, which I think was killing the spirit of youth and punk rock and so on, and in the end he is killed by the little girl who finds the dead deer. It was a very straightforward story on that level, I think, but I never actually read the script, so I don't.
That's nice, because you were supposed to be the assistant director. Okay, do you not have
read
the script?
Well, there wasn't a finished script.
Oh, I see.
Which is one of the reasons it didn't get made, I think. You know.
Right. So my understanding is, since this film was not actually getting made, Malcolm McLaren came to you, who were supposed to be the assistant director of Who Killed Bambi, and asked you to make a documentary about the Sex Pistols.
Right. I was working with the Sex Pistols before the Who Killed Bambi chapter began. I was filming them archivally, in a way, documenting what they were doing. So a lot of this footage in the Filth and the Fury, as was in the Rock and Roll Swindles, came out of that process. So I'd been involved far more as a documentarist capturing that band at the time. I was really asked to show Russ Mayer around, you know, because we didn't really get to make this film. It was very initial. My work as assistant director with Russ Mayer consisted of taking him to punk clubs in London, really, and, you know, trying to calm him down when he realized they didn't have huge tits, as you say. You know.
A great disappointment, I'm sure, to him.
Yeah.
So when you were documenting the Sex Pistols, you know, before making the great Rock and Roll Swindle, was this to be a movie that you were making, or was it something that Malcolm McLaren had asked you to do?
Well, initially, I was at film school at the time, and we were secretly filming them. We had a key to the camera room at the film school, and would, as long as we had the camera back by the morning, would be able to film them at night. If we smuggled the camera into the gig and hid behind pillars and so on, obviously this didn't last for too long, and we were caught doing that.
Caught by who?
By Malcolm, who didn't want anyone filming them without his, you know, permission, which is fair enough, really. But he realized, I think, that a bunch of kids with a camera were probably cheaper than, you know, hiring in film crews, and probably more enthusiastic and more into it than other people would be at that time. So he signed me up to initially to document things. But as the group were banned, we started making little films that could be shown when they were not able to play. And we made a couple of these films out of this material, and material that we'd refilmed from television, and kind of cut up movies that, you know, again, some of the footage in The Filth and Fury comes from those very early movies.
And how did the band feel about being filmed early on?
They hated it. I mean, you probably see in The Filth and the Fury, they were very good at spotting a camera 20 feet away and hitting it with a aimed gob of spit, you know, and you were lucky not to get kicked off the stage. It was difficult filming them because they really didn't like being filmed, although I think they're probably quite glad now that we did film it. At the time, it just wasn't what they were involved in. They just didn't think in terms of capturing what they were doing.
And did it bother you to be spit at while you were trying to film them?
No, that was part of the ritual, part of the fun. I mean, they were getting spat at too, so it wasn't as though
they were part of the scene.
Yeah.
So what connection did you feel to the Sex Pistols as people and to their music?
Well, I loved their music. I mean, it totally re-grounded the original rebellious ideas of rock and roll in a simple, stripped-down way that was accessible to people living lives in London again. You know, during the 70s, that music that had been so important in the 60s in London and moved further and further away from that reality to Hollywood or wherever it had gone, and Sex Pistols just knocked all that on the head and started from ground zero again in a very ferociously honest and angry way, talking about their lives, the lives of the most young kids in England were going through at that point. And it's similar to the hip-hop thing later, obviously, in different contexts in the black community in the States. the great power of their music was that it connected to the reality of people's lives.
My guest is film director Julian Temple. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Julian Temple. His new movie, Pandemonium, is about poets Samuel Taylor Coleridge and William Wordsworth. Temple is also the director of two documentaries about the British punk band The Sex Pistols, the 1978 film The Great Rock and Roll Swindle, and last year's The Filth and the Fury. Here's the recording The Sex Pistols are best known for, Anarchy in the UK. Let's get back to your first Sex Pistols movie, The Great Rock and Roll Swindle. Part of the point of that movie is Malcolm McLaren saying that he created this band, he put it together, he came up with the tactics that got people interested in them and created their image. He takes credit for a lot of the band's identity and a lot of their popular success. Did you agree with that perception when you were making the movie?
Well, you have to take the title at face value. The film is called The Great Rock and Roll Swindle, and it is a swindle and was designed as a swindle in order to make the audience confront what they were feeling about this group at the time. We wrote it together. It was very inspired by F for Fake, for example, where Orson Welles had very much confused what was real and made it seem fictional and vice versa. And we were, in the context of what had happened to the Sex Pistols, trying to do the same thing. When they started, which was only a couple of years before, they wonderfully just destroyed the barrier between an audience and a performer, which had grown out of all proportion in the rock and roll context. The whole stadium thing with ants on stage and thousands of faceless people in the crowd had become very depersonalized and very meaningless. Sex Pistols triumphantly reclaimed the sense of theatre and involvement of the audience as an element in that theatre and said, stand up, you can do it yourself. It was very much empowering people to believe in themselves. 2 years later, when the music industry had done its bit, they had been somehow digested and spat out as new gods to go on your bedroom wall and to be worshipped in the same way that, Rod Stewart or Elvis Presley had been worshipped in the past, the same unthinking way. So the whole point of the Rock and Roll Swindle was to confuse and annoy and confound these fans' ideas about why they should worship a group that was totally opposed to that notion.
And about 18 years after making that movie, you made your movie, The Filth and the Fury, the Sex Pistols documentary that focused on the point of view of the surviving members of the band. How does the story compare when the band tells it?
Well, obviously, it's a very different time, and it wasn't made in the heat of confronting that process that we've just talked about. Having done that, it seemed to me that there were certain debts I owed to the band themselves, that their human story, what it was like for teenagers to be dragged through this kind of chemotherapy of fame and notoriety, and which scarred them all for life. Obviously, Sid didn't get out of it alive, and I feel that they felt that they hadn't had a chance to tell their own story. So It was an interesting and provoking thing to make a film about the same subject in a radically different way.
You're obviously uncomfortable with the corporate intervention in pop culture and the kind of corporate selling of pop culture.
Yeah.
And yet you've made a lot of rock videos, and in a way rock videos kind of represent turning a band into a commercial for the band. You know, it's they really started off, I think, as sales vehicles for the record. And so many rock videos have helped mythologize the rock stars, which is something that you also seem to be uncomfortable about. So have you been ambivalent about being, you know, about making so many rock videos yourself?
Yeah, I had a very mixed mixed feelings about the whole form. Certainly at the beginning of rock videos, one was able to get away with a lot more than you can now. They have been, you know, kind of target audience marketed out of existence, most of them. But at the beginning, you have to understand that record companies knew nothing about film. It was the levels of naivety were quite extraordinary. So you could treat music videos as a, in a sense, a personal comment on those issues that you just raised. And I certainly tried to do that in many of the, particularly, the, I haven't done music videos for some time now anyway, because I think it's a, you know, it's for kids to learn how to make films, really. It's like, instead of film school, it's a good way of trying out and experimenting. But, you know, I think you can say things within rock videos, and still the best ones do, that manage to escape the simple nature of kind of selling fluffy toys to unthinking consumers.
Do you have a favorite of the ones that you did make?
Well, I loved the one I did for Sid Vicious singing My Way. I don't know if you've seen that
I
one.
I have.
Where he
yeah.
shoots the audience at the end. I certainly enjoyed making one called Undercover, where I had the Stones in El Salvador at that time, and had a, I think, I don't know if you remember the scene, Keith Richard is playing one of the Death Squad characters that executes Mick Jagger, who's a journalist there. I mean, those kind of things were possible at that point in time. I don't know whether they are now. I made a film that won the MTV, you know, Best Video of the Year for Neil Young, that was called This Note's for You, which was about Coca-Cola and Pepsi and McDonald's and all those characters sponsoring the soul out of music, and it directly confronted that. It was actually banned on MTV, although it won the Best Video Award of that year. So there were things you could do, and I'm sure there are still things you can do. It's an important audience that these videos reach, and to just treat them as though they're only possible to, you know, disseminate sales pitches to people. I think they can carry much more information than that if someone intelligent gets hold of them, and people are still doing that, I think.
In your own music listening now, do you find yourself listening more to music of the present and trying to keep up with what's new, or do you find yourself also kind of going backwards a lot, catching up on earlier music that you haven't heard, or listening to things that you know and love and want to keep listening to?
I don't like to obsessively listen to things I know and love. I much prefer, as you say, to go back and find things that I would never have countenanced listening to before. That's one side of it. The other side is to go forward and hear what you haven't heard coming at you the other way. You know, I'm not obsessive about keeping up with what's going on, but I have a lot of friends who are involved in music, so I hear a lot anyway, and that's the way I like it. I like people playing me stuff and responding to it or not. You know, I'm not trying to see what's happening every week. I do like a lot of what has been happening. I think dance music, in a way, you know, has got rid of the Sex Pistols altogether, the act on the stage. So there are elements of dance music and hip-hop that I really love, too. But I have got into opera and things that, when I was a punk rocker, I wouldn't have dreamt of enjoying, you know.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, pleasure.
Julian Temple's recent Sex Pistols documentary, The Filth and the Fury, is out on video. His new movie, Pandemonium, is about poets Samuel Taylor Coleridge and William Wordsworth. Here's Sid Vicious live with the Vicious White Kids. This is Fresh Air.